For the evening Dharma talk. And the title of the talk this evening is The Elephant's Footprint. So we've heard a little bit already on this retreat about the Four Noble Truths. And this evening, that's what I'd like to talk about further, in a little bit more depth. The Four Noble Truths was the first teaching that the Buddha gave after his awakening under the Bodhi tree. And sometimes this teaching is referred to as the elephant's footprint, because it's said that the Four Noble Truths encompass the entire teaching in the same way that the footprint of an elephant can encompass the footprints of all other footed beings on earth. So it's a pretty powerful teaching. And to try and do it justice in just 45 minutes, it's a little bit like a speed version. So just to remind you, the Four Noble Truths, there is dukkha in life. The second one, there is an origin to dukkha. And the third, there is an end to dukkha. And the fourth is the path, the Eightfold Noble Path to the end of dukkha. And I mentioned Martin Aylward the other day, a Dharma teacher who lives in France. He was telling me that he was, this is a wee while ago now, he was in San Francisco walking down the street behind two young women, and they were walking and talking to each other, and the conversation went like this. And I'll just hold up a finger to show you which noble truth we're talking about. So I told him, life's hard, life sucks, but you get so uptight, dude, you gotta cool it, man, and learn to let go. So there's the street version of the Four Noble Truths. So in the sutra on setting the wheel of Dharma in motion, the Buddha lays out what each truth is, and Jill's already said quite a bit about that, what each truth is. But the Buddha then goes on to say what our practice is in relation to each truth, so that it's not just four truths, but actually four tasks. And I find it really interesting. Sometimes in the sutras, you'll see exactly the same set of words for each step, but there's one word different. And that highlights to me that word is paired with whatever the task, whatever the truth is. And so the four tasks for each truth, he basically said that it was not until he'd recognized the truth and performed a particular task and then accomplished that task that he could consider himself to be fully awake for each of the four tasks, each of the four truths. And so the four tasks are, the first one is to fully know and comprehend dukkha. So the truth is there is dukkha, and the task is to fully know and comprehend it. The second task is to abandon and let go of the craving and reactivity. So the second truth, there is an origin to dukkha, and the task is to abandon the craving that is the origin. The third truth being there is an end to dukkha, and the task is to realize the stopping of that reactivity, to behold the stopping of that reactivity. And the fourth truth of the Noble Eightfold Path, the task is to cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path, to cultivate that way of life. So I like to think that they're not just truths for us to somehow understand. They're actually practices, they're tasks, really important tasks. So one of the most important insights leading up to the Buddha's awakening was his realization that comprehending suffering lay at the essence of the spiritual path. Comprehending dukkha. And I have a quote here, which is lovely, but I have no idea where it came from, I'm sorry. If you were to go to Africa to photograph the wildlife, you could walk all over the plains looking for the different animals. Or you could sit by the watering hole where all the animals eventually come. Likewise, practice becomes very simple if we pay attention carefully and non-reactively to our suffering. That is, to the contractions, restrictions, and stresses in our body, mind, and heart. For the sake of liberation, what you do and don't need to know will come to you if you simply watch your suffering and its cessation. You will see the grasping, and you will see the possibility of genuine happiness that comes from releasing that grasping. And so when we open to our suffering, our pain, we start to become aware of our habitual mental patterns that have maybe not been apparent before. And we can see this here. These practices that we're taking up can really bring us in touch with our difficulties, painful memories, hurt, sadness, our struggles, our painful patterns that we carry around. And especially around this time on a retreat can be the point where perhaps they're beginning to bubble up, where we're opening to these things. And some of you have spoken about this in the small groups. So as Jill mentioned before, the Buddha didn't use the word suffering. He used the word dukkha. And it's one of these words that we don't really have a good English translation for. But dissatisfaction, stress, dis-ease, discomfort, pain, suffering, a sense of lack. We experience anxiety, stress, regret, resentment, physical pain. We have sensitivities and we're vulnerable. And none of us is free from this dis-ease of life. So this is dukkha. I quite like what teacher Stephen Batchelor has to say about dukkha. He says, dukkha is shorthand for life, as in, well, that's life. You know, you get old, you lose your teeth. Dukkha is the human condition, clearly flagging its tragic dimension, that it will end. Even the joyous and beautiful experiences will be shattered. Nothing is really in the end reliable or sufficiently sound for us to be assured of permanent well-being. It's just not that kind of world. So, well, that's life. So the first truth is that there is dukkha. And we've also been hearing from Jill a little bit about what is dukkha. So she's read the Buddha's words on dukkha, what the Buddha said dukkha was. Birth is dukkha, aging, death. Let me see if I can remember it. Sorrow. You know, pain, sorrow, lamentation, grief and despair, not getting what one wants, association with what one doesn't want, not getting what one wants, association with the disliked, non-association with the liked, and in short, the aggregates clinging. So let's start with birth. We're born. I'm sure that many of you know more about birth than I do. I haven't had the privilege of being present at a birth, and I don't remember being born, although the way my mother tells it, it was a lengthy and painful affair. Apart from that, the only other birth I've attended was that of a cow. And that was truly astonishing, quite miraculous, and utterly mysterious. But it wasn't pretty. You know, this bundle of legs fell about a meter and landed on the ground in a heap. And really, it seemed amazing that it didn't break some bones. And we age. And it's quite funny when you read some of the suttas, they're actually quite graphic about this. So aging is described as decrepitude. We experience decrepitude, brokenness, graying, wrinkling, decline of the life force, and weakening of the faculties. And we all experience that. We can't do the things that we love anymore, perhaps. A couple of years ago, I took part in a Buddhist chaplaincy training. And we did a really telling exercise. And you can try it now, if you like, just in your mind. So I invite you to think of the two people closest to you, the two sense faculties that you would least like to be without, so sight, hearing, smell, taste, sensations, and a functioning mind, so the six senses in the Buddhist tradition. So pick two of those that you'd least like to be without, and two activities that we most love doing. So two people closest, two sense faculties, and two activities. And this was one of those pairs exercises. So we had our six things, you know, on little stickies poking up at the top of a piece of paper. And then our partner was invited to remove one of them. They couldn't see what was written on it, which one they were removing. They just pointed it out and you took it down. And you'd lost that thing, whether it was a loved one, a sense faculty, or an activity. And then a second one. It was really interesting when we did that, noticing how you were really rooting for them not to pick that one. You know, there was some preferences there, even when I only had six things left in my life. And it was pretty raw, actually, and pretty shocking to contemplate being without my most loved one, without a functioning mind, and unable to meditate. Whoa. And so we have aging and death, which involve loss and pain. And we experience not getting what we want, or we find ourselves in the presence of something that we don't want. So all of those things, aging, death, not getting what we want, being in the presence of something that we don't want. So the response to that is often sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So that list of five. And lamentation is, you know, when you're wailing and saying, oh, if only, poor me, all of that, that's lamentation. And maybe we can see that here. So during the days, maybe you've noticed something that you didn't want, an experience, a sensation, a sound, people, maybe the presence of something that you didn't like, a noise that wasn't beautiful, or maybe the weather was too hot or too cold, or maybe it was something the teacher was saying, quite likely. Or maybe you've noticed the absence of something that you did want, you know, like the entertainment of your device, some stimulation perhaps from the dull monotony of sitting and walking. Or maybe it was chocolate. Or maybe you're just wishing you were somewhere else. Or maybe you were really enjoying the meditation and then the bell rang and it ended. Or more likely the lunch period ended and your alarm went off. I don't know. Because all things have the nature of being impermanent. They arise and they pass, and good things come to an end. When we try and hold on to them, try and make them sustain, that's also dukkha. And even the most pleasurable experience cannot provide lasting happiness. I have another Dharma friend who likes to say, "Do you remember that thing you got that made you happy forever after that?" And then he says, "No, me neither." So the first task is to know and comprehend this dukkha. So comprehend, the word comprehend. The com part of it means with. So comprehending in the sense not just of understanding, but of being with it, opening to it fully, knowing it and seeing its process. To do that, we need to turn towards it, to bring curiosity, interest. We don't run away. We don't push it away. Or when we do run away or push it away, we stay and witness the dukkha of both of those forms of avoidance. And you might wonder, what is the point of developing our capacity to be with the difficult, with dukkha? I mean, after all, if my knee hurts, I can just move, right? And it's true, we can avoid a certain amount of suffering. If we have a nice place to live, we create beauty around us, we have a comfortable bed, comfortable clothes, good shoes, good medical care. But we can't avoid all pain. No, emotional pain is much harder to avoid. People do stuff. They're uncontrollable and unpredictable. And there will come a time when we can't avoid physical pain anymore. We'll have no choice. As we age and move towards death, and decrepitude comes into play. I went to the dentist recently because my gums were really sensitive and it felt like they were moving away from my teeth. And he said there was nothing that could be done. You know, this is something that I live with now. I never knew there could be such a thing. All those years of taking it for granted that I couldn't feel my gums, they were fine. So that's there. So bodily pain. And the imminence of death and any fear that we might have about that. You know, life is so uncertain right now with the ecological crisis, global politics, COVID, climate change. We're so vulnerable and so fragile, and we're really just here by a thread. There's so little we actually have control over. So the Buddha actually said that the path to awakening was through suffering. Not around it or bypassing it. He didn't mince words about that. So that might be bad news. The good news is that it turns out that opening to dukkha is also a key part of awakening joy. Because when we open fully to our experience, we not only experience the difficulties, the sorrows, but we also open to the joy and we notice its presence. You know, it said there's only one door to the heart, and if you close it, you lock out both. So we get the 10,000 sorrows, but we also get the 10,000 joys. And David White, who some of you might know, he's a poet, he points to this really beautifully in his poem, The Well of Grief. He says, "Those who will not slip beneath the still surface of the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown away by those who wished for something else." So there's something really precious to discover here. And when we do bear witness to our life playing out, and particularly to the unsatisfactory aspect of it, either the presence of the unpleasant or something pleasant coming to an end, what we notice is how we're relating to that. And mostly we're relating with aversion, resistance. There's a great story that illustrates this. So a farmer sought out the Buddha. The rainy season hadn't come yet. The crops weren't growing. He was really worried about what was going to happen. And the Buddha said, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that." And the farmer got a bit frustrated with that. And he said, "Well, my wife is always criticizing me, giving me a hard time." And the Buddha said, "Well, I can't help you with that either." And the farmer, you know, really puzzled by then, because he thought the Buddha was someone that could help him. He said, "Well, my children are rude to me. They don't listen to me anymore. One is like that and the other's really subservient and I'm worried about him." And the Buddha said, "Well, I can't help you with that either." And the farmer got a bit impatient at that point. And he said, "Well, who are you? You know, you say that you're the Buddha, and you can't help me with any of these problems." And the Buddha said, "Well, each of us at some time has 93 problems, and they come and go. One gets replaced by another. That's what life is. I can only help with the 94th problem." The farmer says, "Oh, what's the 94th problem?" And the Buddha said, "That you want to get rid of the other 93. So often we relate to dukkha as if to say, the universe has delivered this package to the wrong address. It wasn't meant for me. It shouldn't have come to me. I didn't deserve it. I've been much better behaved than that person over there who's doing just fine." Yeah. And so the Buddha had a teaching about that. It's called the teaching of the two arrows. And one of the monks asked him one day, What's the difference between a noble one who has awoken, and an ordinary person? And the Buddha said, well, if you think of, imagine an ordinary person who's hit by an arrow, you know, from a bow and arrow. And that ordinary person not only has the physical pain of that wound, but then they add to it with a layer, an extra layer of, hey, that's not fair. And no, get that off me. I don't like it. Or, golly, I'm useless. I'm such a dick. Of course, it would be me that would get shot. So sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, despair. And he said, it's as if that ordinary person has just invited a second arrow of extra pain, adding to the pain of the first arrow. The noble one, on the other hand, abides peacefully, steadily, with whatever comes. She feels the sensation of the first arrow, the unavoidable pain, but she doesn't add to it. And obviously, if we were really hit by an arrow and suffered a flesh wound, we would do something about it. You know, we'd have it removed. But the point here is the unnecessary suffering that we add to that experience. So the first arrow is the initial event itself, the painful experience, whatever that is. It's happened. We cannot avoid it. The second arrow is the one that we shoot into ourselves. And that's the one, the second arrow is optional. We can add to the initial pain a contracted, angry, rigid, or frightened state of mind. Or we can learn to experience the same painful event with less identification, less aversion, and with a relaxed and compassionate heart. So what is the second arrow? It's all of our reactivity. The thoughts, stories, beliefs, opinions that we tell ourselves, the way we judge ourselves, the resistance, trying to push away, run away, get rid of. Those movements of the mind. In response to the experience, the first experience, the mind is not still. It moves either towards or away from. Some years back, I went on a 3-month silent retreat at Gaia House in England. And what I got to see was this playing out, initially in more obvious ways, but as time went on, more and more subtly, there was just this endless attempt to manipulate my experience, to try and get it the way I wanted it to be. Noticing the experience that I didn't like, so the first arrow, and then reacting to it with a second arrow. So initially it was my leg keeps going to sleep during the sitting, so then get my posture right so my leg doesn't go to sleep, get the cushions right. And then it was realizing thinking makes my jaw tense and it feels unpleasant. And then it was, if I stop thinking, my jaw will relax, and trying to stop thinking. Or it was just wanting peace. And then if I just surrender again, I'll have that peace again. It just went on and on. So it's really important to notice what we're doing. If there's a difficult experience, are we beating ourselves and adding a second arrow? Or are we being kind to ourselves? Which way is our mind moving? Towards the dukkha with kindness, or away from it with aversion? So as we continue our practice together, maybe we find we can move towards, open to, recognize and allow our experience to be there just as it is. To attend and befriend our experience without any need to manipulate or avoid. As we drop into a deeper sensitivity, we find that we have the capacity and the strength to let ourselves feel it, to acknowledge this really hurts, this is painful, with a little less reactivity and a little more openness. With some humility, when we see how little we are in control of our experience, and with a genuine kindness and compassion for ourselves. And actually, it's really a blessing to be able to be with our suffering and not to have to be continually running away all the time. That really is freedom. And so this is the second task, to let go, to abandon the dukkha that we create through our resistance to what is. That's what we're freeing ourselves from, that second arrow. Our practice is to see how we resist and instead to soften into our experience, to let go, to stop clinging onto what we want. And that leads into the third task, to realize or experience the stopping of clinging, the complete cessation of reactivity. So it's not just as the truth says that there is an end, the task is to experience the end. Actually experiencing the end of dukkha, experiencing the mind at rest, in stillness and clarity, with a sense of ease and spaciousness. The Buddha talks about dwelling in emptiness, and it's not an emptiness of experience, but it's an emptiness of reactivity, of movement, of the push-pull of desire and aversion, wanting and resistance. Dwelling in the empty space that opens up when all of that stops. The great Taoist sage Lao Tzu said, "To the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders." Ajahn Sucitto, who's the abbot of one of the monasteries in England, Thai forest tradition monasteries, wonderful teacher, he says, "There's no need to add anything to our experience." So he means there's no need to change or fix it. "There's no need to add anything to our experience. Instead of thinking about it, worrying about it, blaming it, making brave resolutions that we can't keep, or interpreting it and analyzing it and thinking we understand it that way, we reel it in to the point where presence resonates with it." This is the realization that leads to cessation. The movement has stopped, and now it's at rest. Every insight arises from cessation. Something finally stops running. There has to be a moment of cessation in order for wisdom to emerge, for insight to occur. And if, even for a moment, we fully surrender to life, if the mind stops its movement, chasing after the pleasant and running away from the unpleasant, when we finally stop, not only does our suffering stop, but our ignorance stops as well. We see clearly. In the Buddha's definition of dukkha, the last item was, in short, clinging to the five aggregates is dukkha. And the aggregates is the term to describe everything we take to be ourselves, and that's what we're working through in the relational sessions. The things that, the parts that we identify with as me. So basically our body and our mind, aspects of our mind. Reactivity is driven by our identification with our experience as being mine. My experience. I'm hearing. I'm seeing. There's always an I in there somewhere, in the resistance, in the story, in the wanting. I want. It's a story about me. And the Buddha says, in short, the five aggregates clinging, because all of the other items in the list of dukkha, birth and death and aging and all the rest of it, they all involve this sense of self-identification. So seeing through this pattern of creating a self is the way to the end of dukkha. When the mind truly comes to a stop, any identification with mind or body as who I am is seen through. Mind and body drop away. The door into the mystery has opened. We see that we are not separate. We understand our true nature as indivisible from one another. And just in case you were thinking that nirvana sounds like a nice thing to get for yourself, that's not what it's about. In order to wake up, yourself must come to a stop. Momentarily, anyway. So this I, this sense of self, arises and passes, just like all conditioned phenomena. And the arising and passing of self is really painful. It's dukkha, because as long as we consider ourselves to be a separate self, it separates us from each other. It's the origin of fear, because the belief in myself as separate from all this leads to an idea of needing to protect myself from it, from everything that is not me. And perhaps there's moments when you find yourself in this clear, open, empty space, not preoccupied with the things that usually dominate your mind, not being pulled into them. And this is a taste of nirvana, the stopping of reactivity, not in a permanent way, but just for a moment. This habitual reactivity has faded out of its own accord. The Buddha described nirvana as clearly visible and immediate, open to anyone who consciously settles into that still, quiet, clear space. So that's possible for us. There's a story I like of a woman reporter who was on her first retreat, and she said, I cried my way through the first 2 days. All the painstakingly repressed trauma of the past years is rising to the surface. By day 3, I was having panic attacks. On the 5th day, I'm unable to outrun my anxiety. And with nothing left at my disposal to repress it, I finally surrendered. Crouched in a corner of the meditation hall, overrun by terror, I did something I hadn't done in a long time. God, help me, please. Suddenly, a great wave of emotion from the pit of my stomach came surging through my body. I cried for hours, And in the process, I started to touch something soft and still that was witnessing and holding the pain. In the midst of the overwhelming grief, I felt connected to something deep and vast and present. For the first time in ages, I felt that everything, whilst still terrible, was somehow okay. And Shosan Jack Horbner, who I quoted the other day, the Zen monk, describes this way. Turning inward on a meditation cushion was some of the hardest work I'd ever done. One day, it was as though I got to the bottom of my heart, and there was a door, and behind it was my essence, the true me. I turned the handle, but instead of opening inward to some final place, it swung out into a brilliant blue sky. I was staring out the window, completely blown away by the view. There was no me at the bottom of it all. There was a passage to that boundlessness, and the very notion of me was the closed door blocking it. He goes on to say, you were born from emptiness, and now that emptiness is trying to figure out how to be you. There never was any you there to begin with. Nothingness is attempting somethingness, and you are the result. And then his final advice to himself is, so back off and relax, man. Give it some space. Actually, although I said that the Four Noble Truths was the first teaching the Buddha gave after awakening, he did actually give a teaching before that. He was walking from Bodh Gaya, where he'd sat under the Bodhi tree, to Sarnath, where a group of ascetics were practicing, who he'd been previously practicing with. And on the road, he met a man who was also an ascetic, so somebody with a spiritual practice. And this man was really impressed by the Buddha's radiant appearance, and he asked him, wow, what is it that you have discovered? And the Buddha responded, I am the Buddha. And Buddha, the word Buddha, means one who is awake. So he was saying, I am awake. I am enlightened. And this first teaching was not successful because the man wasn't able to understand it. He just thought the Buddha had been practicing too hard and was overestimating himself. He thought the Buddha was saying, I am someone who is awake. I mean, if somebody said those words to you, would you react similarly? You know, what would you do if somebody came up to you and said, I am the perfectly enlightened one? Might call the men in the white coats. Actually, the Buddha's statement was an incredibly accurate, precise teaching. It's really the perfect teaching, but not easy to understand. It sounds like it comes from ego, because we're usually interpreting things from our sense of ego. So I am the perfectly enlightened one may sound like an egotistical statement, but actually he's pointing to our true nature. He was saying, I have discovered that my true nature is Buddha. My true nature is awake. It's not too different from what Zen teachers say today. And this is what the third task is pointing to, discovering our true nature. Anyway, that's not the end of the practice. That's not the goal. That's only the third truth, the third task. And that may come as a surprise that awakening is not the end of the path. The wisdom and compassion that flower from this open space, from touching into the mystery, allow us then to respond to the situations in our life in a new way. Our responses are no longer coming from our conditioning or arising out of past patterns or blinded by personal desire. So the fourth task is to respond appropriately in each situation that arises, not with our habitual behavior, but from that which we really are. So it's learning how to live from the open space, so that's the third truth, that becomes present through embracing the condition that you're in, that's the first truth, letting go of your habitual reactions, the second truth, and beliefs, beholding the space that opens up, that's the third truth, and then responding, that's the fourth truth. And it's really interesting the way the four tasks are laid out. So Jill talked about the doctor and prescription analogy the other day. And that analogy suggests that the fourth task of the Eightfold Path is the prescription for achieving the cure in the third task, which is waking up. And there's certainly no doubt that the Eightfold Path is a useful map for waking up. We listen to teachings of how things are. We set off with good heart, good intention, live an ethical life, non-harming, and we cultivate practices of mindfulness and concentration. And as a result of that, we create an environment for the cessation of reactivity. But it's really significant that the noble truth of awakening comes before the noble truth of the path. And so out of the awakening, we then tread the noble path. So it's like it goes round twice. We tread the noble path the second time, fully inhabiting the realization. Because even after the awakening, there's still work to do. We understand the importance of meditation, the cultivation of awareness, and to continue deepening the realization. Wise understanding is the understanding then that comes from touching into the mystery. Wise intention, the intention for freedom from desire, aversion, and delusion for the benefit of all beings. And out of understanding of our non-separatedness arises action that comes from love and compassion. We can have the idea that there's this endless path stretching out innumerable lifetimes ahead of us, that we're never going to reach the destination in this lifetime. But that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha said, the Dharma, which is difficult to awaken to, the unwise do not see it. It is so near. Awakening is possible here and now in any moment. Reality is ever present. It doesn't come at the end of a path. It comes here and now. So I'd like to just finish with a poem by the Reverend Sapphire Rose. She let go
Without a thought or a word, she let go. She let go of the fear. She let go of the judgments. She let go of the confluence of opinions swarming around her head. She let go of the committee of indecision within her. She let go of all the right reasons. Wholly and completely, without hesitation or worry, she just let go. She didn't ask anyone for advice. She didn't read a book on how to let go. She didn't search the scriptures. She just let go. She let go of all the memories that held her back. She let go of all the anxiety that kept her from moving forward. She let go of the planning and all of the calculations about how to do it just right. She didn't promise to let go. She didn't journal about it. She didn't write the projected date in her day timer. She made no public announcement and put no ad in the paper. She didn't check the weather report or read her daily horoscope. She just let go. She didn't analyze whether she should let go. She didn't call her friends to discuss the matter. She didn't do a 5-step spiritual mind treatment. She didn't call the prayer line. She didn't utter one word. She just let go. No one was around when it happened. There was no applause or congratulations. No one thanked her or praised her. No one noticed a thing. Like a leaf falling from a tree, she just let go. There was no effort. There was no struggle. It wasn't good and it wasn't bad. It was what it was, and it is just that. In the space of letting go, she let it all be. A small smile came over her face. A light breeze blew through her, and the sun and the moon shone forevermore. I'm going to sit for a few moments together.